This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning, Nisa Bulavinaka, and welcome to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. We're coming to you this morning from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Today on the show, Fiji doubles down on its support for Israel at the International Court of Justice.
Fiji respectfully submits that for all these reasons, the court should exercise its judicial discretion to decline to provide an advisory opinion.
And environmental activists warn investors that deep sea mining isn't as profitable as the industry claims.
The way things are drafted provides like a lot of risk to investors and a lot of upfront costs. So if the regulations were just finalized the way they are, they would be expensive and pose a lot of risk.
We'll have more on those stories coming up. I'm Evan Wasuka. But first, Fiji's Women's Minister Linda Tambuya says her removal as deputy leader of her party over an alleged sex scandal is unfair and sets a dangerous precedent. Ms. Tambuya has been the target of blog sites and social media commentary over an alleged affair with a married fellow minister while on an official trip to Melbourne last year. Earlier this week, the Executive Council of the People's Alliance Party announced she's no longer deputy leader because of the scandal's damage to the party's image and reputation. But in a statement provided to Radio New Zealand yesterday, Ms. Tambuya says she's being targeted because she's a woman. She says her party must stand for fairness and justice and make decisions based on evidence and facts, not allegations. So is she being treated differently because she's a woman? Joining us this morning to share her thoughts is Shamima Ali, coordinator of the Fiji Women's Crisis Centre. Good morning, Shamima.
Good morning, Anyandra Vinaka.
Shamima, I'm sure this story is the talk of the town in Suva. What's your take on the decision by the People's Alliance Party to remove Linda Tambuya as their deputy leader?
I believe it is totally unacceptable. Justice has not been served, and for the reasons that she has given, these are allegations, and you can't do this. And this is targeting of a woman leader who is not just a woman leader, but she's also somebody who does not conform to the norm of how women should behave and, you know, and how women should act in front of men, and she's very, very flamboyant. So I think all of that together is totally unacceptable to a very patriarchal society.
Do you think Ms. Tambuya is being targeted differently because she's a woman?
This, as I said, it's yes, definitely because of that, but a woman who stands up for herself.
Now, Ms. Tambuya has paid the price of this alleged affair, but it seems like the other person involved, the former education minister, Seri Randrondro, hasn't faced any consequence apart from public embarrassment. What do you think that says about the Fijian society?
Exactly. As I said, it's very patriarchal. It has double standards for men and women. And women are often judged on their sexuality, sexual behavior, and so on, which men are not. Because when I look at that August House, and I have been, you know, working on women's rights issues for over 30 years in this country. When I look at that, I know all those men, a lot of them. There are men there who are alleged affairies. There are men there who are alleged sexual harassers, wife beaters, I know there are. And there are also some men in there who have been actually proven to have participated in criminal activities and have never paid the price and are sitting there as ministers. So, you know, men are treated differently. And the fact that the former education minister, there hasn't been a whiff of anything about him. It's just his disobedience to the prime minister, but nothing about the alleged affair.
In terms of women's leadership, is this a setback in terms of leadership in Fiji?
Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah, there's a lot of platitudes and rhetoric around women's leadership. We are promoting that. We want more women everywhere and so on. These are just words. They're just platitudes and they don't mean anything. And it really poses a threat to women putting their hands up if they are going to be judged in this way and only on allegations. So not too many women, good women, will be putting women who make a difference. They will not be putting their hands up.
What's the feeling among the community there, particularly with women and those in your circles? What's the reaction been to this latest development in this ongoing story that's sort of captured the nation's attention?
Well, it's the you know, they call it the sex and drug scandal and so on, and so that has captured people's imagination, and we are very judgmental in Fiji and around the Pacific. So that is what has caught the people's imagination. And unfortunately, there are many people that I thought, including women, who would stand by her and who would speak in support of her, haven't done that. And that is very, very sad. But we must remember that Linda pulled the highest votes, second to the prime minister within her party. She has got more votes than the three deputy leaders there, and any of the other women, and so on. And so she has got her own support base, and that support base will stand by her, and people who see clearly through this, that this is a misogynistic attack on her. But yes, there is a lot of talk, and people are very, very judgmental and cruel and unkind, and are not looking at the truth of the matter, but are jumping upon the sex and drug, so-called sex and drug scandal.
You're listening to Pacific Beat. I'm Evan Wasuka, and on the show with me this morning is Shamima Ali, the director of the Fiji Women's Crisis Center. Now, Shamima, what do you think about the role and conduct of the blog sites that were instrumental in publicizing this alleged affair? Do you think they would have made so much noise if the main protagonist was a man?
Not at all. Not at all. It is only because she's a woman, and a woman that has, you know, stood head and shoulders above many men, you know, as well as women, and those are the people that people will target, because, you know, women also have to dump to make it in this world. And in leadership positions, many women that I talk to, they say they have to dumb themselves down in front of men to be able to make it. And that should not be the case. So, yeah.
Now, all eyes will be on Prime Minister Sitiveni Rambuka, because Ms. Tambuya's future as a cabinet minister is in his hands. Look, what would your advice be to the Prime Minister, who's probably weighing up a decision around this case?
I would say to him, do not be swayed by the sycophants that are around him and by the men, and look at the truth of the matter and look at the evidence that is provided, and do what is right. As a leader, he must show common sense, and he must not let somebody who stood by him, but also somebody who is so good for the party and in leadership position for the country, he should make a very sensible and well thought out decision, which should not punish Ms. Tambuya further.
And from your point of view, how would you like to see this whole situation play out? It's been up in the media over the past couple of days. How would you like the situation to be resolved?
Well, I believe that Linda Tambuya has continued with her work despite everything else, and that shows a lot of courage, and she should continue with that, and people should really examine themselves. And, you know, soon, if we didn't talk enough about it, if the media didn't make it headlines all the time, when women do good work, they hardly ever make the headlines. But when it's something like this, they make the headlines. The media have been really hounding Ms. Tambuya. If they did their job, what they're supposed to do, report the truth, and then we can get somewhere, and we can go on with developing this country.
Shamima, thank you very much for joining us this morning on Pacific Beat.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was Shamima Ali. She's the director of the Fiji Women's Crisis in Fiji. Now, staying with Fiji, Fiji's government has doubled down its position supporting Israel at the International Court of Justice. The court had been asked by the UN General Assembly in 2022 to deliver an advisory opinion on Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. Fiji's representative to the UN, Filippo Tarakinikini, urged the court not to deliver an opinion, saying it would disrupt the peace process. Here's a bit of what he told the court.
There are two parties who need to jointly find a solution and they should be supported to do this. Using the advisory opinion procedure to prosecute the alleged violation of international law of one of the parties to the dispute while ignoring possible violations by the other will not promote dialogue nor foster mutual respect. Rather, it is likely to undermine efforts towards peace that can be best settled through the recommitment of the parties to the processes established under the Oslo Accords. In our view, this is why the General Assembly was seriously divided on whether this question should be put to the court for an advisory opinion. And it is also why this Honourable Court should refrain from giving one. Fiji respectfully submits that for all these reasons, the court should exercise its judicial discretion to decline to provide an advisory opinion on the specific question put to it in the UN General Assembly Resolution 77/247. Mr. President, were the court to decide to provide an advisory opinion, which Fiji submits it should not, the court should be cautious to ensure the advisory opinion rendered does not circumvent the binding agreements between the parties, but encourages them to promote fruitful negotiations. Furthermore, the court should ensure that it does not impose obligations and responsibilities on only one party while disregarding its legitimate concerns.
That's Fiji's representative to the UN, Filippo Tarakinikini, and he was speaking there at the International Court of Justice in support of Israel.
Want to immerse yourself in sport and stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Bobby McCumber, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to rugby, and everything in between.
Fresh Off the Field, Thursday afternoon at 4 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
An environmental NGO says the business case for deep-sea mining in the Pacific is unproven and may expose the region to significant financial risks. A new report from the Ocean Foundation claims advocates for the budding industry are using unrealistic financial models and face technological challenges and poor market prospects. It comes as exploratory work continues in the Clarion-Clipperton zone of the Pacific Ocean. Reporter Mackenzie Smith spoke to Bobby Joe Dubosch, a legal officer at the Ocean Foundation, who says the research began by questioning whether deep sea mining could be as profitable as it's been made out by advocates.
Going to be benefits, financial benefits, is there going to be money to be equitably distributed among countries? And we were just kind of realizing that a lot of the conversation, both in the media, but in finance circles and even at the ISA itself, was sort of taking for granted the first two parts of that. We wanted to unpack it a little bit and kind of run down some of the sources and think hard about where that messaging is coming from and if it stands up, and sort of provide a roadmap for folks thinking of either investing in seabed mining or potentially like nations that might consider being like sponsors of a seabed mining company, sort of a roadmap for, diligence, and just saying like, I think based on sort of my movements in this space the last couple of years that a lot of folks are thinking somebody else must have done this homework or we wouldn't be having this conversation in this way. And we were finding that's not necessarily the case.
A lot of the appeal for Pacific Island nations is that this could provide an economic lifeline for future uncertainties. What are some of the economic risks that you think these countries face?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a simple way to think about it is that the economic risks kind of come into three baskets. One, the market risk. Like, what if you just can't sell these minerals, or we can't sell them at the premium that they will likely cost? Metals from the seabed will likely be much more expensive than metals, sourced on land. So what if there's market risk? What if there's no money to be made in the market for these minerals? And as EV batteries move away from cobalt and nickel, which are the two minerals found in polymetallic nodules, particularly, but on the seabed generally, that have been touted as money makers right now. There were just, even as we were writing the report, we were having trouble keeping up with headlines about the implosion of nickel and the way that these prices for both of these commodities are dropping. As EV production rates have soared, you would expect the prices of those materials to go up, and they're in fact going down. So that's, risk number one is market risk. I think risk number two is liability risk. I would frame it as that. Like, there's, again, kind of without, and this exists both in, in domestic and national waters, but I'm more familiar with internationally and on in the area, we call it the seabed below that, in the high seas, beyond national jurisdiction, and then governed by the International Seabed Authority. There are so many unknowns there are draft regulations for exploitation of the seabed. And there's two important things about them. One is they are more unsettled text than settled text. There's so many things that are not decided, and things that would be like existentially important to a company on whether or not they could make money. For example, the royalty rate. How much would a company need to pay the ISA? Would there be money left over afterward? There's something called an environmental performance guarantee that would take the shape of a bond that would have to go, be posted before any mining could happen. Well, all of the details of that have not been figured out. Does the bond have to be cash? Where does it get posted? What's the percentage? All of these like very important financial things. And those are just two examples. And part B of that risk is like the way things are drafted is provides like a lot of risk to investors and a lot of upfront costs. So if the regulations were just finalized the way they are, they would be expensive and pose a lot of risk, but they're not even close to being finalized. So it's just all of this uncertainty. And when you're like a finance or a legal professional, the last thing you want is uncertainty. You want to know like, what kind of risk am I taking on? How much risk? And there's also just these ideas about even jurisdiction. We meaning the international community, isn't sure, like if you're a flag state, meaning you own the boat that's doing the mining, do you have jurisdiction? Do you have responsibility? Do you have rights? If fisheries are disrupted, who does the fishery sue? All of this is just a bunch of question marks.
That was Bobby Jo DeBush, a legal officer at the Ocean Foundation, speaking there with ABC's Mackenzie Smith. In a statement, a spokesperson for the metals company, which is seeking to conduct deep sea mining in the Pacific, says the report from the Ocean Foundation is nonsense prepared by activists who would rather this industry doesn't exist. The spokesperson also said that nodules harvested can be developed reasonably with far fewer costs to both planet and people than mining on land in populated biodiverse ecosystems.
It was missionaries and colonizers who brought the good news, but in the years since, the region has become a melting pot of diverse faiths, beliefs, and philosophies. Pacific Soul explores the higher purposes of Pasifika peoples and asks, what do we believe? And what does it look like in everyday island life? Join host Melissa Macon for a Talanoa about faith and culture on Pacific Soul, Sunday mornings at 8 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
That's right. You're on radio, listening to ABC Radio Australia. This is Pacific Beat, and I'm Evan Wasuka. The shipping industry is both a lifeline for the Pacific and a major contributor to its greatest threat, global warming. After long being a laggard in the fight against climate change, last year at a meeting of the International Maritime Organization, agreed to phase out carbon emissions by 2050. Marshall Islands and Solomon Islands were loud voices at that milestone meeting, but say the job is far from done. They want to see legally binding measures put in place to translate the agreement into action. Atina Schutz will be negotiating for the Marshalls at a follow-up meeting of the IMO later this month. She told a reporter, Liam Fox, that Pacific delegates will continue their push for the adoption of a levy on carbon emissions to fund the transition away from fossil fuels.
2030 is actually one of the indicative checkpoints that we put. So this is really crucial that the shipping industry decarbonize at least by 30% at the end of this decade. Furthermore, the climate breakdown isn't slowing down, and it's not going to wait for anybody. So I think more than ever, the shipping industry needs to really pick it up and do its part.
In the past, Pacific states have been championing a push for a price on carbon. Previously, it was $100 per tonne of carbon. Now you're looking at $150 per tonne. Why that increase?
When we proposed that, we were hoping for it to be operational by 2025. But seeing as we've been delayed for a couple of years, it makes sense to increase that to also take into account the current impacts that we will be seeing during that delay. Also, importantly, because addressing the price differential requires a number of things. So a high price on GHG is one of them. Oh, that can lead to an end on subsidies on oil. But that also provides an opportunity to reinvest the revenues into research and development and deployment, and also ensuring a just and equitable transition.
What are your feelings ahead of the meeting on the level of support you will receive to this proposal from other states?
We have very strong co-sponsorship, not just from the wider Pacific states, but also from Belize in the Caribbean. We're also not the only ones proposing a levy, as you know. The ICH has come with their own proposal, and the European Union has previously spoken strongly in support of having a levy. So we are, I think there's more convergence around a levy. It's just the question of, you know, how much will the quantum be. So we're confident that, you know, our proposal will continue to move forward and stay on the table.
There's the question of what to do with any revenue raised in whatever form it is raised. What are the Pacific states calling for on that front?
We're calling for a large amount of those revenues to go into research and RD&D, or research and development. So that's about less than 50% of that. And then the rest will go into ensuring that all states are able to participate in the transition. So that this goes into things like helping developing states or states in the global south to, you know, be able to conduct their own transition. So this can go into things like investing into newer ships, better, cleaner ships for states. That's just an example.
And other things like if we move to new fuels, potentially hydrogen-based fuels, you'll need all new infrastructure to support that and things like that.
Yes, all of that.
Anything
for states to develop their maritime infrastructure, or to, you know, help decarbonize their fleet. That's a very needed thing, because it's not a global transition if only a few states are able to partake in that.
That's Atina Schutz. She is the Marshall Islands negotiator, and she'll be appearing at the International Maritime Organization meeting later this month. And she was speaking there to the ABC's Liam Fox.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
You're listening to ABC Radio Australia, and this is Pacific Beat. Calls for a treaty to ban the proliferation of fossil fuel is growing. The latest development is being led by young Pacific Island activists, and it's called the Niuli Declaration. The declaration calls on Pacific leaders to support a just and equitable transition to a fossil fuel-free Pacific at the 30th UN climate talks later this year. That declaration was launched just yesterday in Melbourne, and joining us this morning for more on this story is Joseph Sikulu, the Managing Director for 350 Pacific.
Good morning, Evan.
Good morning, Joseph, and welcome to Pacific Beat. Thanks for jumping on the show. But let's start with the declaration. What exactly is the Niuli Declaration, and what is it calling for?
The Niuli Declaration was brought together a couple of weeks ago by joint CSOs who had met in Fiji. And Niuli is a Fijian word for the steering oar. And when we think about global frameworks and legal frameworks, what we need is a North Star or something to guide us in the direction to head that holds all of our aspirations as people. And that's what the Niuli Declaration is. It is a set of demands led by communities across the Pacific asking world leaders and ours to endorse the things that are going to help us shape the future and transition our island and our economies to a renewable future.
Now, Joseph, there's certainly lots of activities happening on the in the climate space. Why should Pacific people, and especially leaders, be paying attention to this new declaration? Why should they be looking closely at the Nayuli Declaration?
Our leaders need to look at the Nayuli Declaration as a direct call from civil society. It is the voice of our people and is the aspirations of our community. And if we want any chance at staving off the worst effects of climate crisis, we need a non-proliferation of fossil fuels. We need to stop our addiction to fossil fuels, and we need to shift that. And we also need to support our communities in this transition and ensure that the technologies available to our communities are current and upfront and are there so that we don't end up with the obsolete renewable energy technologies of the West. And so it's about trying to create the frameworks to guide our people through this transition and through this climate crisis and ensure they have everything they need in order to adapt and remain resilient throughout it.
Now, Joseph, just taking a step back, what does a fossil-free Pacific, what would that look like? And what would it mean for people listening in? And why is this important?
The Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty can be looked at as like an answer to a broken system. Every year, our leaders attend the United Nations Climate Conference, and the hope is to negotiate on all of the legal frameworks, on all of like the finance, on all of the structures that are supposed to support our communities through the climate crisis. But at the moment, that's not working. The Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty is about bringing leaders together to create a framework that is accountable, something that we can all feed into, something that we can all have a say on, and something that should be a reflection of everything that we need and within the time frame that we need. And in the Pacific, treaties like this have worked really well in the past. We can look at the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty that stopped, that was really successful within the Pacific. And that's the aspiration, to create something that is really reflective of our communities and shifts us towards the pathway that we need to see.
Now, Joseph, last year, six Pacific governments in Port Vila, they backed the call for a fossil fuel non-proliferation agreement. How does the Nayuli Declaration fit into that? How does it all work?
So Nayuli is our level. When we're talking about the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty, that is global level. But in order to guide what happens at the global level, we need to galvanize the voices of our own communities first. And so first and foremost, Nayuli Declaration is something that we can all get behind. Community is something that people need to read and see a reflection of themselves in. And then that goes to our leaders as a representation of our voice so that they can carry it forward. So it's how we take part in this process is by first inserting our voices into our own declaration, and then our leaders advocate for that on our behalf.
And the declaration, I understand, was launched yesterday here in Melbourne. What was that event like, and why was Melbourne chosen as the launching point?
In Melbourne, over the last few days, was a Global Citizens event, and it's a really huge event for us, significantly because one of our leaders, Brianna Florin, is one of their awardees, also one of their First Youth awardees, and she's been the real pioneer behind the Fossil Fuel Treaty and the work in bringing youth along this journey. And so we used this platform that she had opened up for us to launch this, because it was a declaration that was contributed to by many youth across the Pacific. And this event gave us a platform in order to be able to do that, something that is seen worldwide. And it was just a really great moment for us to be able to share it there.
And what was the reaction like, the response to this declaration yesterday?
There's going to be a lot of excitement around it. And I think the thing that needs to be looked at is as a tool and a resource. So if anybody out there at community level, or anybody has no understanding around climate or what it is that we're fighting for, you can read the Nayuli Declaration and hear and see explicitly everything that we need, and use it as a tool and a resource whenever you're talking to people about it. And it's important that it was launched here in Australia, because Australians soon will be preparing for a federal election. And so if you want to know what it is Pacific people want or should be demanding for, it will be listed within the Nayuli Declaration.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Evan Wasuka, and I'm chatting with Joseph Sekulu, climate activist, and among those championing the Nayuli Declaration. Now, Joseph, in the declaration, two key words stand out for me. There's just and equitable transition away from fossil fuel. Why is it important to have just and equitable in there, in the text?
It's important to have just and equitable in the text because that's everything that we need. And we know that the way that fossil fuels have been extracted and the history behind that up until today has not been just and it has not been equitable. We've seen Indigenous people especially be dispossessed from their land just to, for profits for extraction to happen across those. And we want to ensure that all communities in this transition have everything they need in order to be able to do that. For us in the Pacific, it's about ensuring that we're at the forefront of this, that we are getting the technology up front, that we have the finances to ensure that our communities can transition really quickly, and that we don't end up becoming a dumping ground for the obsolete technologies of Australia, because that's usually what happens, is that we get the secondhand technology of the West once they've transitioned. And so just and equitable for our islands is ensuring that we're at the forefront of this transition and have the most up-to-date technology to ensure our people have access to all the energy needs that they need.
Now, like you said, this was launched in Australia. Australia is a major fossil fuel exporter. Its economy relies heavily on coal exports. What's the message the Nayuli Declaration is sending to Australia?
We want to work with Australia to ensure that the phase-out of fossil fuels works at a pace that meets the climate crisis, but also ensures that the people of Australia can transition out of it. We want to help and try and build a culture that is no longer dependent on fossil fuels, that demands renewable energy. But we also want to make sure that Australia sticks to the commitments that it has made to our region and the world to help us through this climate crisis. And the Australian government has made so many commitments to climate finance, to loss and damage, to its NDCs, to keeping greenhouse gas emissions down, that it hasn't met yet. And so Nayuli Declaration is first and foremost about accountability for the Australian government and also ensuring that we can all work together across our region as one big family to transition us together.
Now, speaking of the region, 9 Pacific countries support the Treaty on Fossil Fuels. What's being done to get others on board, to get the support from other countries?
That's the work of our youth at the moment and the reason why there was such a big presence in Fiji to create the Nayuli Declaration. And so across the Pacific, young people are going to be approaching their government leaders and their local members of parliament with the Nayuli Declaration in hand, telling them that we've had these conversations and these are our voices and that it is important for the rest of our region to support the Nayuli Declaration and the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty. And so that's a big work ahead of us now, is trying to get the rest of our islands on board of that.
Now, Joseph, young people are playing a key part in terms of climate awareness and activism. Looking ahead into the future, is this a good sign for the region?
It is a great sign for our region that our young people are so vocal, but not just vocal, that they're innovative and that they're thinking of new and incredible ways to tackle this crisis, whether it's taking climate change and the biggest emitters to the highest court in the whole entire world, the International Court of Justice, or if it's the young people working on the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty. Our young people are leading the world in so many different ways. But first and foremost, they're leading the world in some of the most innovative ideas. And that's something that we should be proud of as a region and something that we should look forward to, knowing that the leadership that is growing from our islands is actually really strong. And the future, no matter what happens, is going to be bright for us because of them.
Joseph, thank you very much for your time joining us on Pacific Beat this morning.
Thank you for having me, Evan.
Cheers. That's Joseph Sekulu. He is the Managing Director of 350 Pacific. For millions of Australian women, HPV vaccines are a common and important way of protecting themselves against cervical cancer. But in Timor-Leste, this life-saving medicine isn't widely available, and it's having devastating impacts, with cervical cancer the second most common cancer among women. Now, a program run by the Global Vaccine Alliance, Gavi, is underway to change that. Amber Jacobs with more.
It's a life-saving medicine that's been easily accessible in Australia for more than 15 years. Finally, the HPV vaccine is being widely rolled out to the tiny nation of Timor-Leste.
It's quite important because, of course, the HPV vaccine has been among the highest impact of all Gavi-supported vaccines. Most importantly, you know, really helping drive the decrease in cervical cancer. This is a vaccine that can prevent up to 90% of all cervical cancer cases.
Marie-Ange Sarakiao is the Chief Resource Mobilisation and Growth Officer for Gavi, the International Vaccine Alliance. The organisation aims to increase access to immunisation to low and middle-income countries. Today, it's announced the crucial vaccine will start being delivered to women and girls in Timor-Leste from July this year, with the help of the Australian government.
It is quite a stretch because it's the second most widely cancer there for women. And so being able to have access to the vaccine will make a huge difference, immediately protecting young women and girls there. It's a vaccine that together, thanks to the leadership of Australia, we have been since 2012 bringing up in terms of coverage in a lot of countries that need it. So here, of course, we are extremely excited that Timor-Leste will be introducing the vaccine in the summer of 2024.
There are more than 400,000 women and girls aged 15 years and over in the Southeast Asian nation. They're all at risk of developing cervical cancer at some stage in their lives. While cervical cancer is a preventable disease through immunisation and curable if detected early, according to Gavi, it's the second most frequent cancer among women in Timor. It's a stark contrast to Australia, which in 2007 became the second country in the world to introduce a government-funded vaccine program.
It is a vaccine that has been discovered by an Australian, you know, Professor Ian Fraser. And in a sense, Australia has helped put that science and the finance to bring about this vaccine and make it available to those who need it the most. Actually, Australia may be the first country in the world to eliminate this cancer by 2035. And so it's actually really important that through this leadership, Australia brings the rest of a region that is very important to Australia to bring again more prosperity and productivity into the region.
Despite the support, the rollout in Timor-Leste won't be without challenges. Dr. Arvind Mata is the World Health Organization's representative to Timor-Leste.
Certainly the terrains are tough and vaccinators take that extra step to reach. But in case of HPV, it is actually the adolescent girls which are largely in the school. And those who are not in the school is what the effort will be made so that those are not missed as well.
But he says previously successful vaccine drives in the country, such as the COVID vaccine, mean health workers on the ground are prepared.
We would say that the vaccinators and the health system preparedness is quite okay, whereas we will be doing more and more to engage with the community groups, particularly the school students and their parents and teachers to address the rollout as we plan for July or June rollout.
The World Health Organization believes the elimination of cervical cancer is within reach for all countries, but it says access to vaccines, screening and treatment continues to be scarce in the places that need them most. It means it's crucially important for wealthier nations like Australia to provide financial assistance. Reverend Tim Costello is the Executive Director of MICA Australia, a coalition of Christian international development agencies that advocate against injustice.
Preventative action with immunisations, vaccines, being ready for what might be the next pandemic is absolutely in our self-interest, as well as being right. Aid is far more than just an act of charity.
That's Reverend Tim Costello, Executive Director of MICA Australia, and ending that report by Amber Jacobs and Anna Pikett. Now, soccer is a universally loved sport. For seasonal workers from Timor-Leste employed on berry farms in Tasmania, it's more than just a game. Over there, they've been taking it pretty seriously, playing for bragging rights against rival farms in a friendly competition that's helping workers find their feet in a foreign country. Larissa Smith with this story.
It's a real party vibe at this soccer pitch in the middle of Launceston. This is no ordinary game, though. The players are all from Timor-Leste, and they pick fruit for opposing berry farms.
We're all friendly, but we all, you know, even at a growing level, we want to grow the most berries per hectare or yield or have the fastest pickers. So there's that rivalry, and now it's stemmed out to a soccer rivalry.
Simon Dornorf is the farm manager at Hillwood Berries. He was approached by his pickers to set up some friendly games against other berry farms in the area. So teams were selected, training began, and uniforms were ordered.
Can't take credit for that. That was the guy's idea. They said, oh, we want a Mountford Berries shirt. We want to be part of the Mountford Berries team.
Gemma McKinnon manages the seasonal worker program at Mountford Berries.
My father-in-law said, oh, if we were in England, we'd be very rich, wouldn't we? We've got a soccer team after us. It's something that they talk about. And now that we've played a few games against some of the other farms, it's, oh, we won against this farm and we've lost against this farm, so we've got to play them again to try and beat them. And it's this, there's a talk around the farm while they're there.
For the fruit pickers who have grown up playing soccer back home, these friendly games have helped them feel like they belong here.
I'm Antonio Pinto. My colleague name is Atoy. I've been working for Hillwood Berries in Tasmania for 7 years, since 2017 until now. Soccer is one of the most popular sports in Timor. Last year, we did a soccer with the local people. I can say it's like we like socialize with the people in our, around us, like community, yeah. Part of the community, so that's one of the positive things that we gained during our stay in Australia.
My name is Fernando Nunes da Costa Barreto. They call me Nunes.
I play for Hillwood Berries.
I was amazing today. We hope we keep going doing this activity for the future, so that to make us like feel not only for work, but we also have fun, you know. Like we here during 6 months, or some people working for 1 year, you know, we just keep working, you know. If we just keep working, we don't doing like extra, you know, activity like that, make your life feel boring, you know. We need to create something for everyone to make them express themselves, you know, to other things, so that, you know, not only work for money, but we also need to make some fun for everyone. Yeah.
My full name is Suarez Fatima Oliveira. I'm working in Mountford Berries. It's not a big team.
You're not too bad, and you've got a goal.
Yeah. The first goal, we are so happy with that, yeah.
Who was it?
His name is Esau. Thank you.
He's a gun player?
Yeah.
He's good? Yeah.
Yeah, he's good one. On this win, yeah.
What would you normally be doing at home?
I'm studying, but I have to leave my study because my father was dying. I have to left everything, so I choose to come into work and to help my family.
I'll let you get back to the team. Good luck for the second half.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah.
This is the seasonal worker vibe. Like, you know, there's been footage previously of the Samoan boys singing in hotel quarantine all those years ago, but we see that regularly on the farm. They'll be singing in the field or a laugh, and then that reverberates across the tunnels with other guys laughing just out while they're working. So that real positive energy is what flows through the whole seasonal worker community, and that was on display today with just the energy of doing something fun that's away from work. So these type of events, I think, as we grow into having, you know, longer term workers, we have a community of workers that they all know each other, you know, inter farm relationships too. That mean we can have more things like this. It's not just a Hillwood community on itself. They've got their own friends in other farms and other parts of the state.
The crowds have been amazing, and I can just see the smiles on the faces of the players that they've just had a thoroughly great time.
Yeah, they did. I think there was a winner. I think Mountford won that one. We're sort of friends with the other farms, you know, the bosses at the other farms, so it'll be good bragging rights that our team has won this one, so that's good.
Viva Timor-Leste! Viva! Well, they're certainly having fun there. And the last person there was Gemma McKinnon from Mountford Berries in northern Tasmania. Ending that report from Larissa Smith.
Pacific Beat.
And that's the wrap for Pacific Beat. I'm Evan Wasuka filling in for Agitipo. Join us at 3 p.m. PNG time.